Tiferet. Chapter 64. To dream of living in a new and unknown city means imminent death. In fact, the dead live elsewhere, nor is it known where. Gerolamo Cardano, Somnorium Senesiorum, Basel, 1562, 1:58. While Gevura is the Sephora of awe and evil, Tiferet is the Sephora of beauty and harmony. As Diotalevi said, it is the light of understanding, the tree of life. It is pleasure, hail appearance. It is the concord of law and freedom. And that year was for us the year of pleasure, of the joyful subversion of the great text of the universe, in which we celebrated the nuptials of tradition and the electronic machine. We created, and we delighted in our creation. It was the year in which we invented the plan. For me, at least, it was truly a happy year. Leah's pregnancy proceeded tranquilly, and between Garamond and my agency I was beginning to make a comfortable living. I kept my office in the old factory building, but we remodeled Leah's apartment. The wonderful adventure of metals was now in the hands of the compositors and proofreaders. That was when Signor Garamond had his brainstorm. An illustrated history of magic and the hermetic sciences, with the material that comes in from the diabolicals, with the expertise you three have acquired, with the advice of that incredible man Allier, we can put together a big volume, 400 pages, dazzling full-color plates, in less than a year, reusing some of the graphics from the history of metals. But the subject matter is so different, I said. What can I do with a photograph of a cyclotron? What can you do with it? Imagination, Kasabin, use your imagination. What happens in those atomic machines, in those megatronic positrons, or whatever they're called? Matter is broken down. You put in Swiss cheese, and out come quarks, black holes, churned uranium. It's magic-made flesh, Hermes and Hermes. Here on the left, the engraving of Paracelsus, old abracadabra with his alembics, against a gold background. And on the right, quasars, the Cuisinart of heavy water, gravitational galactic antimatter, etc. Don't you see? The real magician isn't the bleary-eyed guy who doesn't understand a thing. It's the scientist who has grasped the hidden secrets of the universe. Discover the miraculous all around us. Hinted at Mount Palomar, they know more than they're letting on. To encourage me, he gave me a raise, almost perceptible. I concentrated on the miniatures of the Liber Solis of Trismosen, the Mutus Liber of Pseudo-Lullus. I filled folders with pentacles, sephirotic trees, decans, talismans. I combed the loneliest rooms of libraries. I bought dozens of volumes from booksellers who in the old days had peddled the Cultural Revolution. Among the diabolicals, I moved with the ease of a psychiatrist who becomes fond of his patients, enjoying the balmy breezes that waft from the ancient park of his private clinic. After a while, he begins to write pages on delirium, then pages of delirium, unaware that his sick people have seduced him. He thinks he has become an artist. And so the idea of the plan was born. Diotalevi went along with the game because, for him, it was a form of prayer. As for Jacopo Belbo, I thought he was having as much fun as I was. I realize only now that he derived no real pleasure from it. He took part in it nervously, anxiously biting his nails. Or rather, he played along in the hope of finding at least one of the unknown addresses, the stage without footlights, which he mentions in the file named Dream, a surrogate theology for an angel that will never appear. File name, Dream. I don't remember if I dreamed one dream within another, or if they followed one another in the course of the same night, or if they alternated night by night. I am looking for a woman I know. I've had an intense relationship with her, but I cannot figure out why I let it cool. It was my fault, not keeping in touch. Inconceivable that I could have allowed so much time to go by. I am looking for her, or for them. There is more than one woman. There are many. I lost them all in the same way through neglect. And I am seized by uncertainty, because even just one would be enough for me, because I know this, in losing them, I have lost much. As a rule, in my dream, I cannot find, no longer possess, am unable to bring myself to open the address book where the phone number is written, and even if I do open it, it's as if I were far-sighted. I can't read the names. I know where she is, or rather, I don't know where the place is, but I know what it's like. I have the distinct memory of a stairway, a lobby, a landing. I don't rush about the city looking for the place. Instead, I am frozen, blocked by anguish. I keep racking my brain for the reason I permitted or wanted the relationship to cool, the reason I failed to show up at our last meeting. She's waiting for a call from me, I'm sure. If only I knew her name. I know perfectly well who she is, I just can't reconstruct her features. Sometimes, in the half-waking doze that follows, I argue with the dream. You remember everything, I say. You settle all your scores. There's no unfinished business. There is no place you remember whose location you don't know. There is nothing to the dream. But the suspicion remains that I have forgotten something, left something among the folds of my eagerness, the way you forget a banknote or a paper with an important fact in some small marsupial pouch of your trousers or old jacket. And it's only later that you realize it was the most important thing of all, crucial, unique. Of the city, I have a clearer image. It's Paris. I'm on the left bank. And when I cross the river, I find myself in a square that could be Place des Vosges. No, more open, because at the end stands a kind of Madeleine. Passing the square, moving behind the temple, I come to a street. There's a second-hand bookshop on the corner that curves to the right, through a series of alleys that are unquestionably the Barrio Jótico of Barcelona. It could turn into a very broad avenue full of lights, and it's on this avenue, and I remember it with the clarity of a photograph, that I see to the right, at the end of a blind alley, the theater. I'm not sure what happens in that place of pleasure, no doubt something entertaining and slightly louche, like a striptease. For this reason, I don't dare make inquiries, but I know enough to want to return, full of excitement. In vain, toward Chatham Road, the streets become confused. I wake with the taste of failure, an encounter missed. I cannot resign myself to not knowing what I've lost. Sometimes I'm in a country house. It's big. I know there's another wing, but I've forgotten how to reach it, as if the passage has been walled up. In that other wing there are rooms and rooms. I saw them once, and in detail, thoroughly. It's impossible that I dreamed them in another dream. With old furniture and faded engravings, brackets supporting little 19th-century toy theaters made of punched cardboard, sofas with embroidered coverlets, and shelves filled with books, a complete set of the Illustrated Journal of Travel and of Adventures on Land and Sea. It's not true that they came apart from being read so often and that Mama gave them to the trash man. I wonder who got the corridors and stairs mixed up, because that is where I would have liked to build my Buen Retiro, in that odor of precious junk. Why can't I dream of college entrance exams like everybody else? Chapter 65. The frame was 20 foot square, placed in the middle of the room. The superficies was composed of several bits of wood, about the bigness of a die, but some larger than others. They were all linked together by slender wires. These bits of wood were covered on every square with paper pasted on them, and on these papers were written all the words of their language, in their several moods, tenses, and declensions, but without any order. The pupils at his command took each of them hold of an iron handle, whereof there were 40 fixed round the edges of the frame, and giving them a sudden turn, the whole disposition of the words was entirely changed. He then commanded 36 of the lads to read the several lines softly as they appeared upon the frame, and where they found 3 or 4 words together that might make part of a sentence, they dictated to the 4 remaining boys. Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels, Roman 3:5. I believe that in embellishing his dream, Belbo returned once again to the idea of lost opportunity and his vow of renunciation, to his life's failure to seize, if it ever existed, the moment. The plan began because Belbo had now resigned himself to creating private, fictitious moments. I asked him for some text or other, and he rummaged through the papers on his desk, where there was a heap of manuscripts perilously piled one on top of the other, with no concern for weight or size. He found the one he was looking for and tried to slip it out, thus causing the others to spill to the floor. Folders came open, pages escaped their flimsy containers. "Couldn't you have moved the top half first?" I asked, wasting my breath. This was how he always did it. He replied, as he always did, "Gudrun will pick them up this evening. She has to have a mission in life, otherwise she loses her identity." But this time I had a personal stake in the safety of the manuscripts, because I was now part of the firm. "Gudrun won't be able to put them back together," I said. "She'll put the wrong pages in the wrong folders." "If Dio Talevi heard you, he'd rejoice. A way of producing different books, eclectic, random books. It's part of the logic of the diabolicals. But we'd find ourselves in the situation of the Kabbalists, taking millennia to discover the right combination. You're simply using Gudrun in place of the monkey that spends an eternity at the typewriter. As far as evolution goes, we've made no progress, unless there's some program in Abulafia to do this work. Meanwhile, Diotalevi had come in.
Of course there is, Belbo said, and in theory, you could have up to 2,000 entries. All that's needed is the data and the desire. Take, for example, poetry. The program asks you how many lines you want in the poem, and you decide, 10, 20, 100. Then the program randomizes the line numbers, in other words, a new arrangement each time. With 10 lines, you can make thousands and thousands of random poems. Yesterday, I entered such lines as, "And the linden trees quiver, thou sinister albatross, the rubber plant is free, I offer thee my life," and so on. Here are some of my better efforts. "I count the nights, the sistrum sounds. Death, thy victory, the rubber plant is free. From the heart of dawn, thou sinister albatross, the rubber plant is free. Death, thy victory. And the linden trees quiver, I count the nights, the sistrum sounds. The hoopoe awaits me, and the linden trees quiver."
It's repetitive, yes, but repetitions can make poetic sense.
Interesting, Diotalevi said. This reconciles me to your machine. So if we fed it the entire Torah and told it, what's the term, to randomize, it would perform some authentic Temura, recombining the verses of the book?
Yes, but it's a question of time. That would take centuries.
I said, what if instead you fed it a few dozen notions taken from the works of the Diabolicals? For example, the Templars fled to Scotland, or the Corpus Hermeticum arrived in Florence in 1460, and threw in a few connective phrases like, it's obvious that, and this proves that. We might end up with something revelatory. Then we fill in the gaps, call the repetitions prophecies, and voila, a hitherto unpublished chapter of the history of magic, at the very least.
An idea of genius, Belbo said. Let's start right away.
Now it's 7 o'clock tomorrow.
I'm starting tonight. Help me just for a minute.
Pick up, say, 20 of those pages on the floor at random. Glance at the first sentence of each, and that will be an entry. I bent over, picked up, and read, Joseph of Arimathea carries the Grail into France.
Excellent.
I've written it. Go on.
According to the Templar tradition, Godefroy de Bouillon founded the Grand Priory of Zion in Jerusalem.
And Debussy was a Rosicrucian.
Excuse me, Diotalevi said, but you also have to include some neutral data. For example, the koala lives in Australia, or Papin invented the pressure cooker.
Minnie Mouse is Mickey's fiancée.
We mustn't overdo it.
No, we mustn't overdo it. If we admit that in the whole universe there is even a single fact that does not reveal a mystery, then we violate hermetic thought.
That's true. Minnie's in, and if you'll allow me, I'll add a fundamental axiom. The Templars have something to do with everything.
That goes without saying, Diotalevi agreed.
We went on for a while, but then it was really late. Belbo told us not to worry, he'd continue on his own. When Gudrun came in and told us she was locking up, he said he'd be staying to do some work and asked her to pick up the papers on the floor. Gudrun made sounds that could have belonged either to Latin sine flexione or to Chermish, but that clearly expressed indignation and dismay, which demonstrated the universal kinship of all languages, descendants branched from a single Adamic root. She obeyed, randomizing, better than any computer. The next morning, Belbo was radiant.
It works, he said. It works beyond anything we could have hoped for.
He handed us the printout.
The Templars have something to do with everything. What follows is not true. Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate. The sage Omus founded the Rosy Cross in Egypt. There are Kabbalists in Provence. Who was married at the Feast of Cana? Minnie Mouse is Mickey's fiancée. It logically follows that, if the Druids venerated black virgins, then Simon Magus identifies Sophia as a prostitute of Tyre. Who was married at the Feast of Cana? The Merovingians proclaim themselves kings by divine right. The Templars have something to do with everything.
A bit obscure, Diotalevi said.
Because you don't see the connections, and you don't give due importance to the question that recurs twice, who was married at the Feast of Cana? Repetitions are magic keys. Of course, I've compiled, but compiling the truth is the initiate's right. Here is my interpretation. Jesus was not crucified, and for that reason the Templars denied the crucifix. The legend of Joseph of Arimathea covers a deeper truth. Jesus, not the Grail, landed in France among the Kabbalists of Provence. Jesus is the metaphor of the King of the World, the true founder of the Rosicrucians. And who landed with Jesus? His wife. In the Gospels, why aren't we told who was married at Cana? It was the wedding of Jesus, and it was a wedding that could not be discussed because the bride was a public sinner, Mary Magdalene. That's why, ever since, all the Illuminati from Simon Magus to Postel seek the principle of the eternal feminine in a brothel. And Jesus, meanwhile, was the founder of the royal line of France. Chapter 66. If our hypothesis is correct, the Holy Grail was the breed and descendant of Jesus, the Sang Real, of which the Templars were the guardians. At the same time, the Holy Grail must have been literally the vessel that had received and contained the blood of Jesus. In other words, it must have been the womb of the Magdalene. M. Bagent, R. Lee, H. Lincoln, The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, 1982, London, Cape, Roman 14. Nobody would take that seriously, Diotelevi said. On the contrary, it would sell a few 100,000 copies, I said grimly. The story has already been written with slight variations in a book on the mystery of the Grail and the secrets of Rennes-le-Château. Instead of reading only manuscripts, you should look at what other publishers are printing. Ye holy seraphim, Diotelevi said. Then this machine says only what we already know. And he went out, dejected. Belbo was piqued. What is he saying, that my idea is an idea others have had? So what? It's called literary polygenesis. Signor Garamond would say that means I'm telling the truth. It must have taken years for the others to come up with it, whereas the machine and I solved the problem in one evening. I'm with you, the machine's useful. But I believe we should feed in more statements that don't come from the diabolicals. The challenge isn't to find occult links between Debussy and the Templars. Everybody does that. The problem is to find occult links between, for example, Kabbalah and the spark plugs of a car. I was speaking off the top of my head, but I had given Belbo an idea. He talked to me about it a few mornings later. You were right. Any fact becomes important when it's connected to another. The connection changes the perspective. It leads you to think that every detail of the world, every voice, every word, written or spoken, has more than its literal meaning. That it tells us of a secret. The rule is simple. Suspect. Only suspect. You can read subtexts even in a traffic sign that says no littering. Of course, Catharist moralism, the horror of fornication. Last night I happened to come across a driver's manual. Maybe it was the semi-darkness or what you had said to me, but I began to imagine that those pages were saying something else. Suppose the automobile existed only to serve as a metaphor of creation. And we mustn't confine ourselves to the exterior or to the surface reality of the dashboard. We must learn to see what only the maker sees, what lies beneath. What lies beneath and what lies above. It is the tree of the Sephiroth. You don't say. I'm not the one who says it. It is the thing itself that says. The drive shaft is the trunk of the tree. Count the parts. Engine, two front wheels, clutch, transmission, two axles, differential and two rear wheels. 10 parts. 10 Sephiroth. But the positions don't coincide. Who says they don't? Diotelevi's explained to us that in certain versions, Tiferet isn't the 6th Sephiroth, but the 8th, below Neza and Hod. My axle tree is the tree of Belbop. Fiat. But let's pursue the dialectic of the tree. At the summit is the engine, omnia movens, of which more later. This is the creative source. The engine communicates its creative energy to the two front or higher wheels, the wheel of intelligence and the wheel of knowledge. If the car has front-wheel drive. The good thing about the Belbop tree is that it allows metaphysical alternatives. So we have the image of a spiritual cosmos with front-wheel drive, where the engine, in front, transmits its wishes to the higher wheels, whereas in the materialistic version we have a degenerate cosmos in which motion is imparted by the engine to the two lower wheels. From the depths, the cosmic emanation releases the base forces of matter. What about an engine in back, rear-wheel drive? Satanic,
Higher and lower coincide. God is identified with the motion of crude matter. God as an eternally frustrated aspiration to divinity, the result of the breaking of the vessels.
Not the breaking of the muffler?
That occurs in aborted universes, where the noxious breath of the archons spreads through the ether. But we mustn't digress. After the engine and two wheels comes the clutch, the sephira of grace that establishes or interrupts the flow of love that binds the rest of the tree to the supernal energy. A disc, a mandala, that caresses another mandala. Then the coffer of change, the gearbox, or transmission, as the positivists call it, which is the principle of evil, because it allows human will to speed up or slow down the constant process of emanation. For this reason, an automatic transmission costs more, for there it is the tree itself that decides, in accordance with its own sovereign equilibrium. Then comes the universal joint, the axle, the drive shaft, the differential. Note the opposition repetition of the quaternion of cylinders in the engine, because the differential, minor Keter, transmits motion to the earthly wheels. Here the function of the sephira of difference is obvious, as, with a majestic sense of beauty, it distributes the cosmic forces to the wheel of glory and the wheel of victory, which, in an unaborted universe, front-wheel drive, are the subordinate to the motion imparted by the higher wheels.
A coherent exegesis. And the heart of the engine, seat of the one, the crown?
You have to but look with the eyes of an initiate. The supreme engine lives by an alternation of intake and exhaust. A complex divine respiration, a cycle initially based on two units called cylinders, an obvious geometrical archetype, which then generate a third, and finally gaze upon another in mutual love and bring forth the glory of a fourth. In the cycle of the first cylinder, none is first hierarchically, but only through the miraculous alternation of position, the piston, etymology pistis sophia, descends from the upper neutral position to the lower neutral position as the cylinder fills with energy in the pure state. I'm simplifying, because here angelic hierarchies come into play, the distributor caps, which, as my handbook says, allow the opening and closing of the apertures that link the interior of the cylinders to the induction pipes leading out of the carburetor. The inner seat of the engine can communicate with the rest of the cosmos only through this mediation, and here, I believe, is revealed, I am reluctant to utter heresy, the original limit of the One, which, in order to create, somehow depends on the great eccentrics. A closer reading of the text may be required here. The cylinder fills with energy, the piston returns to the upper neutral position and achieves maximum compression, the Simson. And lo, the glory of the Big Bang, combustion, expansion, a spark flies, the mixture of fuel flares and blazes, and this the handbook calls the active phase of the cycle. And woe, woe, if in the mixture of fuel the shells intrude, the kelapot, drops of impure matter like water or Coca-Cola. Then expansion does not take place or occurs in abortive starts.
Then the meaning of shell is kelapot? We'd better not use it anymore. From now on, only virgin's milk.
We'll check. It could be a trick of the seven sisters, lower emanations trying to control the process of creation. In any case, after expansion, behold the great divine release, the exhaust. The piston rises again to the upper neutral position and expels the formless matter, now combusted. Only if this process of purification succeeds can the new cycle begin, which, if you think about it, is also the Neoplatonic mechanism of Exodus and Parados, miraculous dialectic of the way up and the way down.
Quantum mortalia pectora ceacae noctis habent. And the sons of matter never realized it.
They never saw the connection between the Philosopher's Stone and Firestone. For tomorrow, I'll prepare a mystical interpretation of the phone book.
Ever ambitious, Arkasaban.
Mind you, there you'll have to solve the unfathomable problem of the one and the many. Better succeed slowly. Start instead with the washing machine.
Well, that's too easy. The alchemistic transformation from black to whiter than white.
Chapter 67. Da Rosa Naradigamos Agora. Sampaio Bruno, Os Cavalheiros do Amor, Lisbon, Guimarães, 1960, page 155. When you assume an attitude of suspicion, you overlook no clue. After our fantasy on the power train and the tree of the Sephiroth,
I was prepared to see symbols in every object I came upon. I had kept in touch with my Brazilian friends, and in Portugal, just then, at Coimbra, a conference was being held on Lusitanian culture. More out of a wish to see me again than out of respect for my expertise, my Rio friends managed to have me invited. Leah didn't go with me. She was in her 7th month, and though her pregnancy had changed her slender figure only slightly, transforming her into a Flemish Madonna, she preferred to stay home. I spent 3 merry evenings with my old comrades. As we were returning by bus to Lisbon, an argument developed about whether we should stop at Fatima or Tomar. Tomar was the castle to which the Portuguese Templars had withdrawn after the king and the pope saved them from trial and ruin by transforming them into the Order of the Knights of Christ. I couldn't miss a Templar castle, and luckily the rest of the party was not enthusiastic about Fatima. If I could have invented a Templar castle, it would have been Tomar. You reach it by ascending a fortified road that flanks the outer bastions, which have cruciform slits, and you breathe crusader air from the first moment. The Knights of Christ prospered for centuries in that place. Tradition has it that both Henry the Navigator and Christopher Columbus belonged to that order, and in fact it devoted itself to the conquest of the seas, making the fortune of Portugal. The knight's long and happy existence there had caused the castle to be rebuilt and extended through the centuries, so to its medieval part were joined Renaissance and Baroque wings. I was moved as I entered the Church of the Templars, which had an octagonal rotunda reproducing that of the Holy Sepulchre, and I was surprised to see that the Templars' crosses had different forms, depending on their location. It was a problem I had encountered before, when I went through the confused iconography on the subject. Whereas the cross of the Knights of Malta had remained more or less the same, the Templar cross had been influenced by periods and local traditions. That's why Templar hunters, finding any kind of cross in a place, immediately think they've discovered a trace of the knights. Our guide took us to see the Manueline window, the Janela par excellence, a filigree, a collage of marine and submarine troves, seaweeds, shells, anchors, capstans and chains, celebrating the knights' achievements on the oceans. The window was framed by 2 towers, which were decorated with carvings of the insignia of the garter. What was the symbol of an English order doing in a Portuguese fortified monastery? The guide couldn't say. But a little later, on another side, the northeast, I believe, he showed us the insignia of the Golden Fleece. I couldn't help thinking of the subtle game of alliances that had united the garter to the Golden Fleece, the Fleece to the Argonauts to the Grail, and the Grail to the Templars. Remembering Colonel Ardenti's narrative and a few pages from the Diabolical's manuscripts, I started when our guide showed us into a side room whose ceiling was gripped by keystones. They were rosettes, but on some of them was carved a bearded Capron face, Baphomet. We went down into a crypt. After 7 steps, a bare stone floor led to the apse, where an altar could stand, or the chair of the Grand Master. You reached it by passing beneath 7 keystones, each in the form of a rose, one larger than the next, with the last set over a well. The cross and the rose in a Templar monastery, and in a room surely built before the Rosicrucian manifestos. I put some questions to the guide. He smiled. If you knew how many students of the occult sciences come here on pilgrimages, it said that this was the initiation chamber. Entering by chance a room not yet restored, which contained a few pieces of dusty furniture, I found the floor cluttered with great cardboard boxes. Rummaging at random, I uncovered some fragments of volumes in Hebrew, presumably from the 17th century. What were the Jews doing in Tomar? The guide told me that the knights had maintained friendly relations with the local Jewish community. He had me look out the window and showed me a little garden designed like an elegant French maze, the work, he told me, of an 18th century Jewish architect, Samuel Schwartz. The second appointment in Jerusalem, and the first at the castle? Wasn't that how the message of Provins went? By God, the castle of the ordination mentioned in Ingolf's document was not the Montsalva of chivalric novels, the Avalon of the Hyperboreal. No. What castle would the Templars of Provins, more used to directing commanderies than to reading romances of the Round Table, have chosen for their first meeting place? Why, Tomar, the castle of the Knights of Christ, a place where survivors of the order enjoyed complete freedom, unchanged guarantees, and where they could be in contact with the agents of the second group. I left Tomar in Portugal with my mind ablaze. No longer was I laughing at the message Ardenti had shown us. The Templars, when they became a secret order, worked out a plan that was to last 600 years and conclude in our century.
The Templars were serious men. If they talked about a castle, they meant a real castle. The plan began at Tomar. And what would the ideal route have been, the sequence of the other five meetings? Places where the Templars could count on friendship, protection, complicity. The colonel spoke of Stonehenge, Avalon, Agartha. Nonsense. The message had to be completely restudied. Of course, I reminded myself on my way home, the idea is not to discover the Templar's secret, but to construct it. Belbo seemed disturbed at the thought of going back to the document left by the colonel, and he found it only after digging reluctantly in a lower drawer. But I saw he had kept it. Together we reread the Provin message after so many years. It began with the message coded by the method of Tritemius. Les transis invisibles séparés en six bandes. And then, Allah, ellipsis, Saint-Jean, transis, P, charrette de fin, Cise, ellipsis, entier avec Sahel, P, ellipsis, les blancs montiacs, R, ellipsis, S, ellipsis, chevalier de Proin pour la, ellipsis, J, N, C, 6 × 6 en 6 places, chacun fois 20 à, ellipsis, 120 à, ellipsis, Icest et l'ordination, Al donjon li premier, ili secunds just issieux qui, ellipsis, pan, ita refuge, ita Notre-Dame de l'autre part de Lyo, it à l'hôtel des Poplequins, ita la pierre, 3 × 6 avant la fête, ellipsis, la grand pute. 36 years after the Heywain, the Knight of St. John of the year 1344, 6 sealed messages for the knights with the white cloaks, the relapsed knights of Provins, revenge. 6 × 6 in 6 places, 20 years each time, for a total of 120 years. This is the plan. The first at the castle, then with those who ate the bread, then at the refuge, then at Our Lady beyond the river, then at the house of the Poplicans, then at the stone. You see, in 1344 the message says that the first must go to the castle, and in fact the knights were established in Tomar in 1357. Now we must ask ourselves where the second group went. Come on, imagine you're an escaping Templar. Where would you go to form the second group? If it's true that those in the Wayne fled to Scotland, but why should they have gone to Scotland in particular to eat the bread? I was becoming a master of chains of association. You could start anywhere. Scotland, Highlands, Druidic Rites, Night of St. John, Summer Solstice, St. John's Fire, Golden Bough. Because I had read about St. John's Fire in Fraser's Golden Bough. I telephoned Leah. Do me a favor, get the Golden Bough and see what it says about St. John's Fire. Leah was terrific at this sort of thing. She found the chapter at once. What do you want to know? It's a very ancient rite, practiced in almost all European countries. It's celebrated at the moment when the sun is at its peak. St. John was added to make the thing Christian. Do they eat bread in Scotland? Let me see, I don't think so. Oh, here it is. They don't eat bread for St. John, but on the night of the 1st of May, the night of the Beltane fires, originally a Druid festival, they eat bread, especially in the Scottish Highlands. We've got it. What kind? They knead a cake of flour and oats and toast it on embers. Then a rite follows that recalls ancient human sacrifices. The bread's called bannock cakes. What? Spell it. She did, and I thanked her. I told her she was my Beatrice, my Morgan Le Fay, and other endearments. I tried to remember my thesis. The secret group, according to the legend, took refuge in Scotland with King Robert the Bruce, and the Templars helped the king win the Battle of Bannockburn. In reward, the king set them up as the new order of the Knights of St. Andrew of Scotland. I took a big English dictionary down from the shelf and looked up Bannock, B-A-N-N-O-C-K, B-A-N-N-O-K in Middle English, B-A-N-N-U-C in Anglo-Saxon, B-A-N-N-A-C-H in Gaelic. A kind of cake, cooked on a grill or a slab made of barley, oats, or other grain. Burn is a stream. You had only to translate Bannockburn as the French Templars would have done when they sent news from Scotland to their compatriots in Provins, and you get something like the stream of the cake, or of the loaf, or of the bread. Those who ate the bread were those who had won at the stream of the bread, and hence the Scottish group, which perhaps by that time had spread throughout the British Isles. Logical, from Portugal to England. That was a shorter route, much shorter than Ardentes from Pole to Palestine. Chapter 68. Let your garments be white. If it is dark, set many lights burning. Now begin combining letters, few, many, shift them and combine them until your heart is warm. Pay attention to the movement of the letters and to what you can produce by combining them. And when your heart is warm, when you see that through the combination of the letters you grasp things you could not have known by yourself or with the aid of tradition, when you are ready to receive the influence of the divine power that enters into you, then use all the profundity of your thought to imagine in your heart the name and his higher angels, as if they were human beings beside you. Abulafia, Sefer HaYaOlam. It makes sense, Belbo said, and in that case, where would the refuge be? The six groups settle in six places, but only one place is called the refuge. Odd. This must mean that in the other places, like Portugal and Britain, the Templars can live undisturbed, although under another name, whereas in the refuge they are completely hidden. I would say it is where the Templars of Paris went after they left the Temple. To me it seems economical for the route to go to England from France, but why not assume that the Templars took an even more economical course and set up a refuge in a secret and protected place in Paris itself? Being sound politicians, they reasoned that in 200 years the situation would change and they would be able to act in the light of day, or almost. Paris it is. And the fourth place? And the fourth place? The colonel was thinking of Chartres, but if we make Paris the third place, we can't put down Chartres as the fourth, because obviously the plan has to involve all the centers of Europe. Besides, we're leaving the mystical trail to work out a political trail. The pattern appears to be a sine wave, so we should go to the north of Germany. Beyond the water, that is, beyond the Rhine, there's a city, not a church, of Our Lady. Near Danzig, there's a city of the Virgin, in other words, Marienburg. Why meet at Marienburg? Because it was the seat of the Teutonic Knights. Relations between the Templars and the Teutonics hadn't been poisoned like those between the Templars and the Hospitallers, who had waited like vultures for the suppression of the Temple in order to seize its wealth. The Teutonics were created in Palestine by German emperors as a counterbalance to the Templars, but they were soon called north to stem the invasion of Prussian barbarians. They succeeded so well that in the space of 2 centuries they became a state that spread out all over the Baltic lands. They moved between Poland, Lithuania, and Livonia. They founded Königsberg. They were defeated only once by Alexander Nevsky in Estonia. About the time the Templars were arrested in Paris, the Teutonics established the capital of their realm at Marienburg. If there was any spiritual knighthood plan of world conquest, the Templars and the Teutonics had divided the spheres of influence between them. You know what? Belbo said. I'm with you. Now the fifth group. Where are these Poplicans? I don't know, I said. You disappoint me, Kasaban. Maybe we should ask Abulafia. No, Abulafia can only connect facts, not create them. The Poplicans are a fact, not a connection, and facts are the province of Sam Spade. Give me a few days. I'll give you 2 weeks, Belbo said. If within 2 weeks you don't hand the Poplicans over to me, you'll buy me a bottle of 12-year-old Ballantines. Beyond my means. A week later, I delivered the Poplicans to my greedy partners. It's all clear. Now follow me, because we must go back to the 4th century, to Byzantium, when various movements of Manichaean inspiration have already spread throughout the Mediterranean. We begin with the Archontics, founded in Armenia by Peter of Capabaruca, and you have to admit that's a pretty grand name. Anti-Semitic, the Archontics identify the devil with Sabaoth, the god of the Jews, who lives in the 7th heaven. To reach the Great Mother of Light in the 8th heaven, it is necessary to reject both Sabaoth and baptism, all right? Consider them rejected, Belbo said. But the Archontics are still nice kids at heart. In the 5th century, the Messalians come along, and actually they survive until the 11th century in Thrace. The Messalians are not dualists, but Monarchians, and they have dealings with the infernal powers, and in fact some texts call them Borborites, from Borboros, filth, because of the unspeakable things they do. What do they do? The usual unspeakable things. Men and women hold in the palm of their hand and raise to heaven their own ignominy, namely sperm or menstruum, then eat it, calling it the body of Christ. And if by chance a woman is made pregnant, at the opportune moment they stick a hand into her womb, pull out the embryo, throw it into a mortar, mix in some honey and pepper, and gobble it up. How revolting! Honey and pepper, Dio Talevi said. So those are the Messalians, also known as Stratiotics and Phibionites, or Barbalites, who are made up of Nassians and Phemianites. But for other fathers of the church, the Barbalites were Latter-day Gnostics, therefore dualists, who worshipped the great mother Barbalo. And their initiates in turn called the Borborites Hylix, or children of matter, as distinct from the psychics, who were already a step up, and the pneumatics, who were the truly elect, the rotary club of the whole business. But maybe the Stratiotics were the only Hylix of the Mithraists. Sounds a bit confused, Belbo said. Naturally, none of these people left records. The only things we know about them come to us from the gossip of their enemies. But no matter. I'm just trying to show you what a mess the Middle East was at the time, and to set the stage for the Paulicians. These are the followers of a certain Paul, joined by some iconoclasts expelled from Albania. From the 8th century on, the Paulicians grow rapidly. The sect becomes a community, the community of force, a political power, and the emperors of Byzantium, beginning to get worried, send the imperial armies against them. The Paulicians extend as far as the confines of the Arab world. They spread toward the Euphrates and northward as far as the Black Sea. They establish colonies more or less everywhere, and we find them as late as the 17th century, when they are converted by the Jesuits, and some communities still exist today in the Balkans or thereabouts. Now, what do the Paulicians believe in? In God, 1 and 3, except that the Demiurge defiantly created the world, with the unfortunate results visible to all. The Paulicians reject the Old Testament, refuse the sacraments, despise the cross, and don't honor the Virgin, because Christ was incarnated directly in heaven and passed through Mary as through a pipe. The Bogomils, who are partly derived from them, say that Christ went in one ear of Mary and came out the other without her even noticing. The Paulicians are also accused of worshipping the Son and the Devil, and of mixing children's blood in their bread and the Eucharistic wine. Well, like everybody else. Those were the days when, for a heretic, going to Mass was a torment. Might as well become Muslim. Anyway, that's the sort of people they were. And I'm telling you about them because, when the dualist heretics spread through Italy and Provence, they are called, to indicate that they're like the Paulicians, Poplicans, Publicans, Populicans, who Gallice etiam dicuntur ab aliquis Popelicant. So there they are. Yes, finally. The Paulicians continue into the 9th century, driving the Byzantine emperors crazy until Emperor Basil vows that if he gets his hand on their leader, Chrysocheir, who invaded the Church of St. John of God at Ephesus and watered his horse at the holy water fonts. A familiar nasty habit, Belbo said. He'll shoot 3 arrows into his head. He sends the imperial army after Chrysocheir. They capture him, cut off his head, send it to the emperor, who places it on a table, or a trumeau on a little porphyry column, and shoots 3 arrows, wham, 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 into it, probably an arrow for each eye and the third for the mouth. Nice folks, Dio Talevi said. They didn't do it to be mean, Belbo said. It was a question of faith. Go on, Kasaban. Our Dio Talevi doesn't understand theological fine points. To conclude, the Crusaders encountered the Paulicians. They come upon them near Antioch in the course of the First Crusade, where the heretics are fighting alongside the Arabs, and they encounter them also at the siege of Constantinople, where the Paulician community of Philippopolis tries to hand the city over to the Bulgarian Tsar Ioannitsa to spite the French, as Villardouin tells us. There's the connection with the Templars, and the solution to our riddle. Legend has the Templars inspired by the Cathars, but it's really the other way around. The Templars, encountering the Paulician communities in the course of the Crusades, established mysterious relations with them, as they had before with the mystics and the Muslim heretics. Just follow the track of the ordination. It has to pass through the Balkans. Why? Because, clearly, the 6th appointment is in Jerusalem. The message says, go to the stone. And where is there a stone,
a rock which the Moslems venerate, and for which, if we want to see it, we have to take off our shoes? Why, right in the center of the Mosque of Omar in Jerusalem, where once stood the Temple of the Templars. I don't know who was to wait in Jerusalem, perhaps a core group of surviving and disguised Templars, or else some Kabbalists connected with the Portuguese, but this much is certain. To reach Jerusalem from Germany, the most logical route is through the Balkans, and there the fifth group, the Paulician one, was waiting. You see how straightforward and economical the plan becomes? I must say I'm persuaded, Belbo said. But where in the Balkans were the Poplicans waiting? If you ask me, the natural successors of the Paulicians were the Bulgarian Bogomils, but the Templars of Provence couldn't have known that a few years later Bulgaria would be invaded by the Turks and remain under their dominion for 5 centuries. Which would suggest that the plan was interrupted at the link between Germany and Bulgaria. When was that to take place?
In 1824, Diotalevi said.
Why is that? Diotalevi quickly sketched the following diagram. Portugal, 1344, England, 1464, France, 1584, Germany, 1704, Bulgaria, 1824, Jerusalem, 1944. In 1344, the first Grand Masters of each group established themselves in the 6 prescribed places. In the course of 120 years, 6 Grand Masters succeed one another in each group, and in 1464, the 6th Master of Tomar meets the 6th Master of the English group. In 1584, the 12th English Master meets the 12th French Master. The chain proceeds at this pace, so if the appointment with the Paulicians fails, it must fail in 1824.
Let's assume it fails, I said. But I don't understand why such shrewd men, when they had 4/6 of the message in their hands, weren't able to reconstruct it. Or why, if the appointment with the Bulgarians fell through, they didn't get in touch with the next group.
Kasaban, Belbo said, do you really think the lawmakers of Provence were fools? If they wanted the revelation to remain concealed for 600 years, they must have taken precautions. Every master of a group knows where to find the master of the following group, but not where to find the others, and none of the later groups know where to find the masters of the preceding groups. If the Germans lose the Bulgarians, they'll never know where the Jerusalemites are, and the Jerusalemites won't know where anyone else is. As for reconstructing a message from incomplete pieces, that depends on how the message has been divided, certainly not in logical sequence. So if only one piece is missing, the message is incomprehensible, and the one who has that missing piece can't make any use of it.
Just think, Diotalevi said. If the Bulgarian meeting didn't take place, Europe today is the theater of a secret ballet, with groups seeking and not finding one another, while each group knows that one small piece of information might be enough to make it master of the world. What's the name of that taxidermist you told us about, Kasaban? Maybe a plot really exists, and history is simply the result of this battle to reconstruct a lost message. We don't see them, but invisible, they act all around us.
The same idea then occurred to Belbo and to me. We both started talking, and we quickly worked out the right connection. In addition, we discovered that at least 2 expressions in the Provence message, the reference to 36 invisibles divided into 6 groups, and the 120-year deadline, also appeared in the debate on the Rosicrucians. After all, they were Germans, I said. I'll read the Rosicrucian manifestos.
But you said the manifestos were fake, Belbo said.
So, what we're putting together is fake.
True, he said. I was forgetting that.
Chapter 69. Elle devient le diable, débile, timorée, vaillante à des heures exceptionnelles, sanglante sans cesse, lacrimante, caressante, avec des bras qui ignorent les lois. Fille, fille, elles ne valent rien, elles sont faites d'un côté, d'un os courbe, d'une dissimulation rentrée. Elle baise le serpent. Jules Bois, Le satanisme et la magie, Paris, Chailly, 1895, page 12.
He was forgetting that, yes. The following file, brief and dazed, surely belongs to this period. File name, Anoia. You arrived at the house suddenly with your grass. I didn't want any. I won't allow any vegetable substance to interfere with the functioning of my brain.
I'm lying. I smoke tobacco, drink distillations of grain. The few times in the early 60s when somebody forced me to share in the circulation of a joint with that cheap, slimy paper impregnated with saliva, and the last drag using a pin, I wanted to laugh. But yesterday it was you offering it to me, and I thought that maybe this was your way of offering yourself, so I smoked, trusting. We danced close, the way nobody's danced for years, and the shame of it, while Mahler's Fourth was playing. I felt as if in my arms an ancient creature were yeasting, with the sweet and wrinkled face of an old nanny goat, a serpent rising from the depths of my loins, and I worshipped you as a very old and universal aunt. Probably I went on holding my body close to yours, but I felt also that you were in flight, ascending, being transformed into gold, opening locked doors, moving objects through the air as I penetrated your dark belly, Megaleopophysis, prisoner of the angels. Was it not you I sought all along? I am here, always waiting for you. Did I lose you each time because I didn't recognize you? Did I lose you each time because I did recognize you but was afraid? Lose you because each time, recognizing you, I knew I had to lose you? But where did you end up last night? I woke this morning with a headache. Chapter 70. Let us remember well, however, the secret references to a period of 120 years that Brother A, the successor of D, and last of the second line of succession, who lived among many of us, addressed to us, we of the third line of succession. Fama Fraternitatis in Allgemeine und Generalreformation, Kassel, Wesel, 1614. First thing, I read through the two manifestos of the Rosicrucians, the Fama and the Confessio. I also took a look at the Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreuz by Johann Valentin Andrei, because Andrei was the presumed author of the manifestos. The two manifestos appeared in Germany between 1614 and 1615, thus about 30 years after the 1584 meeting between the French and English Templars, and almost a century before the French were to meet with the Germans. I read, not to believe what the manifestos said, but to look beyond them, as if the words meant something else. To help them mean something else, I knew I should skip some passages and attach more importance to some statements than to others. But this was exactly what the diabolicals and their masters were teaching us. If you move in the refined time of revelation, do not follow the fussy Philistine chains of logic and their monotonous sequentiality. Taken literally, these two texts were a pile of absurdities, riddles, contradictions. Therefore, they could not be saying what they seemed to be saying, and were neither a call to profound spiritual reformation, nor the story of poor Christian Rosenkreuz. They were a coded message to be read by superimposing them on a grid that left certain spaces free while covering others. Like the coded message of Provins, where only the initial letters counted. Having no grid, I had to assume the existence of one. I had to read with mistrust. The manifestos spoke of the plan of Provins. There could be no doubt about that. In the grave of C.R., allegory of the Grand Jourdain, the night of June 23, 1344, a treasure had been placed for posterity to discover, a treasure hidden for 120 years. It was not money, that much was clear. Not only was there a polemic against the unrestrained greed of the alchemists, but the text said openly that what had been promised was a great historical change. And if the reader failed to understand that, the second manifesto said that there could be no ignoring an offer that concerned the Miranda Sextae Aetatis, the wonders of the sixth and final appointment. And it repeated, if only it had pleased God to bring down to us the light of his sixth candelabrum. If only we could read everything in a single book, and, reading it, understand and remember. How pleasant it would be if through song, the message read aloud, we could transform rocks, lapis exilis, into pearls and precious stones. And there was further talk of arcane secrets, and of a government that was to be established in Europe, and of a great work to be achieved. It was said that C.R. had gone to Spain, or Portugal, and had shown the learned there whence to draw the true indicia of future centuries. But in vain. Why in vain? Was it because a group of German Templars at the beginning of the 17th century made public a very closely guarded secret, forced to come out into the open on account of a halt in the process of the transmission of the message?
The manifestos undeniably tried to reconstruct the phases of the plan as Diotalevi had summarized them. The first brother whose death was mentioned was Brother I.O., who had come to the end in England. So, someone had arrived triumphantly at the first appointment. And a second line of succession was mentioned, and a third. Thus far, all was apparently in order. The second line, the English one, met the third line, the French one, in 1584. Those writing at the beginning of the 17th century spoke only of what had happened to the first three groups. In The Chemical Wedding, written by Andrei in his youth, hence before the manifestos, even if they appeared as early as 1614, three majestic temples were mentioned, the three places that must already have been known. Yet, reading, I realized that while the two manifestos did indeed speak later in the same terms as The Chemical Wedding, it was as if something upsetting had happened meanwhile. For example, why such insistence on the fact that the time had come, the moment had come, though the enemy had employed all his tricks to keep the occasion from materializing? What occasion? It was said that CR's final goal was Jerusalem, but he hadn't been able to reach Jerusalem. Why not? The Arabs were praised because they exchanged messages, but in Germany the learned didn't know how to assist one another. What did that mean? And there was a reference to a larger group that wants the pasture all for itself. Evidently some party, pursuing its private interests, was trying to upset the plan, and evidently there had been, in fact, a serious setback. The farmer said that at the beginning someone had worked out a magic writing, why, of course, the message of Provins, but that the clock of God struck every minute, whereas ours is unable to strike even the hours. Who had missed the strokes of the divine clock? Who had failed to arrive at a certain place at the right moment? There was a reference to an original group of brothers who could have revealed a secret philosophy but had decided instead to disperse throughout the world. The manifestos breathed uneasiness, uncertainty, bewilderment. The brothers of the first lines of succession had each arranged to be replaced by a worthy successor, but they decided to keep secret the place of their burial, and even today we do not know where they are buried. What did this really refer to? What sepulchre was without an address? It was becoming obvious to me that the manifestos were written because some information had been lost. An appeal was being made to anyone who happened to possess that information. He should come forward. The end of the Fama was unequivocal. Again, we ask all the learned of Europe to consider with kindly disposition our offer to let us know their reflections, because even if for the present we have not revealed our names, anyone who sends us his name will be able to confer with us personally, or, if some impediment exists, in writing. This was exactly what the colonel had intended to do by publishing his story, force someone to emerge from his silence. There had been a gap, a hiatus, an unraveling. In the tomb of C.R. there was written not only post centum vigintianos patebo, to recall the schedule of the appointments, but also ne quaquam vacuum, not the void does not exist, but the void should not exist. A void had been created, and it had to be filled. Once again, I asked myself, why were these things being said in Germany, where, if anything, the fourth line should simply wait with saintly patience for its own turn to come? The Germans couldn't complain, in 1614, of a failed appointment in Marienburg, because the Marienburg appointment would not take place until 1704. Only one conclusion was possible. The Germans were complaining because the preceding appointment had not taken place. This was the key. The Germans, the fourth line, were lamenting the fact that the English, the second line, had failed to reach the French, the third line. Of course, in the text you could find allegories that were almost childishly transparent. The tomb of CR is opened, and in it are found the signatures of the brothers of the first and second circles, but not of the third. The Portuguese and the English are there, but where are the French? In other words, the English had missed the French. Yet the English, according to what we had established, were the only ones who had any idea where to find the French, just as the French were the only ones who had any idea where to find the Germans. So even if the French found the Germans in 1704, they would have shown up minus two-thirds of what they were supposed to deliver. The Rosicrucians came out into the open, accepting the known risks, because that was the only way to save the plan.